Welcome to the Into the Wilderness podcast. I'm your host, Timothy Regal. I'm very excited today to talk to Michael Foster. Michael is the pastor of East River Church in Batavia, Ohio. He's director of itsgoodtobeaman.com and author of the upcoming book, It's Good to Be a Man, and founder of County Before Country. Michael, welcome. Glad to talk to you today. Thanks for joining me.
Yeah, glad to be on. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. I listen to your sermons all the time. I love listening to your sermons on your podcast from your church. I love your unapologetic dedication to preaching scripture in the Bible, regardless of whether it offends anybody. I'm unafraid to preach about tough topics, and few pastors are willing to go those places these days, and I really appreciate that. So you run a website called itsgoodtobeaman.com, and you're about to release a book called It's Good to Be a Man. So in today's world, where that shouldn't be a controversial phrase, but it is, why is it good to be a man, and why does today's church need good men?
Yeah, so in the book of Genesis, it says God made man in his image, male and female, he made them, right? And you go down a couple of verses when he's surveying all of creation, everything he's made, and he said it was very good, right? So he's talking about not just moral goodness, but completion, perfection. Everything's ordered right. Everything's designed as it ought to be. So, you know, if you ever had just, you ever listened to the perfect C chord, right?
Sure.
You know, or have the perfect cup of coffee or whatever, something that's made just right. So when God was done with creation on the sixth day, everything was made as was supposed to be, and there was nothing wrong with it. The design was perfect. It was glorious. Everything fit together the way it was supposed to fit together. So it's very, very good. And so when we say it's good to be a man, you're talking about that God is the creator of maleness. God is the creator of a binary sexuality, male, female, and they're good in themselves, right? Like the good example would be sex. So sex, heterosexual sex, is natural. And when done according to God's purpose, it's great, right? It's good. It's good. It has value. It has purpose. Telos is what we like to call it, which is kind of like its ultimate aim or goal of it. But when something like that is twisted, it can become very dangerous, like pornography, which is what you do in your coaching work with men, is that pornography is the twisting of sexual desire, the twisting of sexual activity to make something terrible. So the world has men that are immoral men, right? They're bad men. They don't live their life according to the design of God, in the commands of God. But even then, their maleness is not in itself bad. Like the desire to have a woman, the erotic desire, ambition to conquer, to rule things is not bad. The desire for a brotherhood with a shared mission is not bad, right? But the desire for a shared mission could be a bunch of gang. It could be gang members. It could be guys working together to do evil things. That's why the first chapter of the book of Proverbs, King Solomon warns his son about guys that would say, hey, come on, let's go do this thing together. We'll jump these people. We'll take their stuff. And we'll share the spoils. That's because all of us want a fraternity of men to run with. And with ambition, you can either be, you look at Genesis right away, you have this tension between city builders and those that aren't. And that happens all the way up to Jerusalem. City builders are always seen as bad in the Old Testament. It's not because cities in themselves are bad, but because the first city builder was Cain. So God, after Cain kills his brother, God has mercy on him, makes him a vagabond in the world, and says you shouldn't settle down anywhere. Well, in rebellion, the first thing Cain does is settle down, and he builds a city, and he names it after his son. Now, we're sentimentalists. We think, that's so sweet. No, it's because he wants to make a name for himself. He wants to make himself great. And it's interesting that the Sethites, those that descend from the third brother, right? You got Cain, Abel, and then Seth. What they're defined by is that they begin to call in the name of the Lord. So they're worshipers of the name of the Lord. And then you have this tension. You see all the way up to the Tower of Babel, where in the Tower of Babel, they try to construct this big city, which becomes Babylon, which is the evil city forever. And at the and then the purpose is to make their name great in the heavens. Then you get all the way up to the day of Pentecost. On the day of Pentecost, you have people. So in Babel, everyone speaks one language, and they use that united cooperation and desire to build their name great, to show that they're godlike. In Pentecost, which is fascinating, Acts chapter 2, is you have all these people that speak different languages, and when they're speaking in tongues on the day of Pentecost, and when they hear them speaking in all these different languages, they're praising the name of God, right? So when men unite for evil purposes, it leads to destruction, and God can unite people around himself. So there's this tension between building a name. In the book of Proverbs, it says that a good name is of, you know, of great value. So men have ambition to make their name great. And that's fine if it's done in the service of God. We should want that. We should want a legacy. We should want our great-grandchildren to do great things for the Lord. And so even ambition, you know, is good in that way. When it's not selfish, when it's centered on the Lord, that's something we don't see much in the church these days. Is men are, they're not very driven to do great things. They're very comfortable. Yeah, you know, Pink Floyd, yeah. Comfortably numb sort of stuff. And then with Eros, with coitus, sex, sex has a telos. Someone asked me the other day, why was America unable to stop the lesbian gay agenda? Well, it's because we redefined the purpose of marriage to a sort of homosexual sense, right? So one thing, like, how long does a homosexual society, if everyone's homosexual, and we only are given to natural ways of reproducing, how long does a homosexual society last? Well, one generation, right? Right. You can't reproduce yourself. So one of the purposes of sex, according to Malachi 2:15, is God desires a godly seed. It's to fill the world. It's to fill the world with people. And so you go all the way back to Genesis, as God tells man to rule and reign and to be fruitful and multiply. Right. So what God wanted in this world was a man and a woman to be joined together in a covenant, and through purposeful, fruitful, excellent sex, fill the world with worshipers that would shape everything, build everything for the glory of God. And that is what men need. That's why it's good to be a man. Now, to be a good man is to have your life reordered to that. And there's a lot of guys that think, because they're polite or nice or easygoing, that they're a good man, and they're good.
Christian, nice guy.
Yeah. And they may be good in the sense that they're not immediately dangerous, but men that aren't dangerous are their own danger, because the world is full with men that are evil and are controlled by their sinful desires and twist male aggression to not be something that you use to protect and overcome, but something you use to persecute and oppress. Mm-hmm. And so we need men that are good at being men. This is something Jack Donovan has makes a point of in The Way of Men. I think he puts it well, is that, you know, there's a difference between being good at being a man and being a good man. Mm-hmm. And they should come together. So what we did with our website, as we looked out there, we saw websites and podcasts and materials that are basically telling Christian men to be good, but without rooting it in God's design for their life. And so everything's very kind of detached. Men feel ashamed of their sexuality. Men aren't called to do great things. Men are mocked for their desire to have a group of men. It's interesting. You watch sitcoms and it's always the woman trying to get the guy to come back home and stop hanging out with his friends. Well, we all know that world's long gone, and most guys are very alienated, and they think hanging out with their friends is scrolling Twitter. You know, they don't really have that, and guys definitely need that. So we wanted to create content that kind of brought that all together. And that's what we did with we started with the Facebook page. I started it, and then I found a co-author and kind of a co-leader, my friend Non Tennant, who's a Kiwi, he's out of New Zealand. And then we created the podcast, and slowly but surely it kind of took off. And these days, trying to keep up with the amount of content or questions that people ask, I'm sure you get even at the size that your Twitter is, that's about where you start getting tons, you know, of emails and tons of DMs, right? It's hard to, and hard questions. People don't ever ask you simple. They don't like, you get a couple simple ones, but then there's always like, I had this famous one. I had this guy email me and tell me that he had his penis ripped off in a car accident and wanted to know how he could live a normal life. And I was like, wow. You can't live a normal life, right? You've had a horrific accident, and now you have to. This is why you better believe in the resurrection, right? The goodness of the gospel, because if everything is now, that's what you see a lot in the manosphere space. It's basically hedonistic. And you know, I always tell people, if you don't have a doctrine of death, right, you don't, you can't talk to people about what it means to be a man. It'll end up falling apart, because you have to ask, what is the final telos of everything? But so we wanted to create content that reached people like that, and God's blessed it. And we're just trying to be faithful. We've monetized a couple things, but we, you know, I'm a pastor, you know, I'm not, you know, freely I receive, freely I give. So
absolutely. Absolutely. So yeah, it's good to be a man because God created man, and everything that God created is good. And same with sex. God created sex. He designed it for marriage and between a man and woman. So what happened that over the millennia since God created the world and scripture was written, that it became not good to be a man and sex became this taboo thing that you don't talk about?
Yeah. Well, there's definitely different waves of things that have happened. So things got twisted right away, first off, with Cain being the first murderer. Sure. Then you get to polygamy with Lamech. You get to really evil marriages in Genesis chapter 6. You get to women and kind of transgenders being priests in pagan temples. Like, you get that all like early, early on.
Right. Potiphar's wife and Joseph.
This stuff, you know, none of this is new. What is a little different? Something that's more of an artifact of our current, you know, where we're at culturally, is the actual belief in that sexuality exists just on a spectrum, and that sex, as in what we would call gender today, the biological ontological reality, doesn't have a set nature from which roles come out of. So what we say is there's always been this sort of pagan idea of androgyny. And so in paganism, a lot of times the priest is neither female or male, or somehow they have this deep, like they can blend between the two. They always have this androgynous sexual interchangeability. That's kind of become the norm now, right? Like for a long time, if you're a homosexual, it was because you were born that way, right? You can't, you don't have a choice about it. Right, but now, like, you can choose your sexuality. Mondays, you could be this. Tuesdays, you could be that. Sure. And if you say otherwise, so which is it? Is sexuality set? Is it part of a design? Or is it a choose-your-own-adventure book, right? And so that's been crazy. And that probably ties back. It really, all three phases, waves of feminism has been bad, but I also think romanticism did a lot of harm back in the 1700s in that somehow women became to be seen as cleaner and more pure than men, and that masculinity was a more base desire. And I think that's partially tied to overplaying of the bridal metaphor in scripture for Jesus being the groom and the church being the bride, and then seeing the Christian relationship to Christ as romantic and feminine in nature. And that got overplayed. Bernard of Clairvaux was big on bridal mysticism. That's like 12th, 13th century. And then that all kind of builds up towards romanticism, where now where Christianity is associated with feminine inclinations, it makes sense that people read that back in and say, well, women are more holy. Men are, you know, less holy by their nature. They're like, you know, men are more like animals. Men are dogs, right?
Right.
So then all that kind of been hovering in the back of Christianity for a long time. You'll read Cotton Mather, who was part of the colonialists, right? The colonies here in America, talking about, wow, I see a lot of women, where are all the men at? Right. So people think, well,
absolutely,
you know, and so this has been building, it gets to a ridiculous place in the 1940s with Alfred Kinsey in Bloomington, really the father of the modern sexual revolution. Kinsey is a pervert, mm-hmm. does terrible, terrible things. And pardon me, but with Kinsey, he creates a couple reports on human sexuality that are very influential in the government. Basically how we educate, how we teach, how we think about it. The studies are very flawed and not right, but that flows into the 60s, where we now move into, towards the end of that decade, contraceptive and no fault divorce. Then that really starts to take root in the 80s. So I'm 41, born in 1980. And I can remember in early grade school that still having divorced parents was really rare. It was like one or two kids in your class, yeah. right? But through the 80s into the 90s, that stuff starts to like explode. And so fathers are taken out of the homes, marriages are breaking down. These are the basic building blocks of any community, any society. And then you throw ease of getting porn. To get porn has been easier and easier. Usually if you wanted to have illicit sex, you had to take risk. You had to go to a whore in some bad part of town. Someone yeah. might see you. You might get robbed. She might rob you. You know, there we go. Froze for a moment. You had to go to the bad part of town. And then there's a point where you could get all this stuff where you could get it via mail, like a catalog.
Yeah.
And then, you know, you could go get it at a store and you could go see it. But then the internet happened. I'm thankful that I was born when I was, because the internet porn wasn't a problem for me, because it wasn't there. If you wanted to get internet porn, I mean, I don't know, you have to download that stuff. You're gonna have to be really committed. It's gonna take hours and hours and hours to do that. I mean, with Napster, how we used to get our songs, like to download a freaking song off Napster was like a 4-hour.
Oh yeah, commitment. You'd start it at night and hopefully it was done in the morning. Yeah.
And so then as you move in to the 2000s, where we get high speed internet, porn really takes off. At first it costs money, so people are still scared to do that, but then it starts to be free because we're making money off ad revenue. And in 2006 you get the Android phone, 2007 you get the iPhone, and now you get high def porn streaming right to your hand at any time.
Absolutely.
So these things have like attacked society. They've redirected men. There's a sort of hatred of men, a sort of misandric nature to our culture, thinking that men are more evil, they're more violent, that you have to smash the patriarchy because they do all these mm-hmm. bad things. And then the fact is, most men are freaking weak as can be, not driven, and they've had their masculine energy sapped by giving themselves to pornography. And some women in pornography are just wicked. Proverbs 5, Proverbs 7, women that are using mm-hmm. their sexuality. And some of them are just been kidnapped or drugged,
right.
or human trafficked.
A lot of trafficking,
you know, yeah, it's a mixture of the both. Point is now those men have taken their sexual desire, which is supposed to be an engine of productivity. And it's now they don't have that. And they just sit around and they don't build anything. And they feel they have a bad conscience. You know, it's hard for them to stand up to anyone. I can always tell a guy when his wife caught him with looking at porn, because she's kind of like towers over him. He doesn't have mm-hmm. any moral leadership. He's very broken down. So I'm sure you have dealt with that.
I've absolutely seen that. And I think some of the worst things to happen to men and masculinity, especially Christian men, is that everything that defines, or some of the major things that define a man, and have been told that they're bad. So we talked about sex is good and men desiring sex is good. That's how we be fruitful and multiply. And that's become a bad thing. Men, like we said, are pigs. They're just horny all the time. And that's all they care about. That's, you know, all they want is sex. Or on the other side of it, to where men bonding with other men, all of a sudden, at some point, that became gay.
Yeah.
And I think those things
that kids used to hold hands. Guys used to hold hands walking down the road. We can't conceive of that. Yeah. Like, we cannot conceive of that sort of intimacy. We have been robbed by, I mean, what we've been robbed of is when you start to go back and read history and look at way things actually used to work, we're like, oh my goodness, the rebuild is the work of generations. The work I've started cannot be completed by me. I need my kids and my grandkids to carry the torch forward, you know?
And I think that's why it's important to live out God's plan and to be fruitful and multiply and have children. When the rest of society is saying, no, I don't want to have children. You shouldn't have children. That's bad. You know, we as Christian men and fathers and leaders should be having children so that we can, so we can spread the gospel, yes, but also have this generational change.
With MGTOW, men going their own way, in the Black Pill sort of movement, you know, in the manosphere, there's no way, or the men's space, whatever you want to call it, that you don't start to interact with these ideas. I think older generations kind of dispel those movements without taking some of their concerns seriously. In terms of just trying to find a good spouse, trying to find, or when you have a kid, when you have kids and build a life together, the fact that there's no fault divorce, family court and divorce court tends to be biased towards the man. Churches will, because they misunderstand male headship, think a man is the cause for all the problems in the marriage. So if his wife leaves him, it's his fault. It may be his responsibility to deal with it, but responsibility doesn't necessarily mean cause, right? Mm-hmm. It just means you have to deal with it. If I have a kid that acts like a nut job, right, then I gotta discipline him. He's my, him acting that way is my responsibility, but I didn't necessarily cause it. My wife leaving me, I have to decide what I'm gonna do. I'm gonna divorce her, you know, whatever. You know, you gotta make those decisions. So, but the church doesn't understand that, so they'll take the side of the woman almost no matter what. It's like crazy. And so
even male pastors do that.
Especially male pastors, they will, because they want to be a hero. They want to feel that makes them feel like a man. They're coming in to defend my lady. So these guys look at that and say, hey, how in the world are we why should I get married into this system? Right. I mean, I don't want to have half my stuff taken or more and my kids ripped away from me and be zeroed out and all this stuff. So first, what you have to say is like, all right, number one, there is absolute risk involved and there are a way to mitigate those risks. And life is full of risk. And there's no way to get around that to some deal. Like either you don't actually take that exact same concern and apply it to all your life, or you would, I mean, you'd never get anything done. You know, all the best things in my life were risky, you know?
Sure.
So first you say, okay, I got you that there's risk and I don't want to downplay it. And it's your decision to do what you want to do. But what I asked them, I say, look, you say there has to be all this legal reform. Can we get that legal reform done in a single generation? What do you think? Well, probably not.
No.
All right. So who's the next generation to continue the reform? Where do they come from? All right. If you're backing out of society, and you're like, well, it's just going to all collapse and they'll learn their lesson, which is seems to be what they think. And I'm like, well, I don't think that's what's going to happen. But what we need is families so we can raise up godly daughters to marry godly men and godly men that can marry godly daughters, and that they can together continue the reform. This is a multi-generational project. And men going their own way is individualism, their own way, right? We want men to go, and I want to sound cheesy, but God's way, and say, well, what does God want us to do? What's the right? How do we rebuild society? Well, society starts with men rebuilding themselves, right? Taking responsibility for themselves, but building a household, like a productive household, a marriage with purpose that has children and raising them up and building a community. That's why I started County Before Country. You know, that's what we did, is like, you know, hey, let's go local here, guys. You know, instead of, what can I do about Joe Biden? You know, what can I do? I can't do anything.
Right.
You know, like, and why talk about him? Why spend all that mental energy? Spend that mental energy right here where you're at, in your politics, in your schools, in your neighborhoods. Most people don't even know the name of their neighbors. And they talk, I hear these guys talk about all the problems with society. Well, what are you doing about it? What are you going to do about it? Well, what can someone do about it? You can do things, dude.
Right.
So when you say, what can someone do about it? That, let me translate that. I ain't doing nothing. That's what that means. Right. And so men are men of action. So what I see in that movement are men that have been burned, bad time, terrible divorces, terrible things, thrown under the bus by the church, or passive men who are easily scared by risk in their little calculators. Always walk around calculating all the risk. You know, man, if I calculated all the risk, I wouldn't have any of these things. You know, I just threw myself into life and God has been very kind. I'm not saying, then they'll say you have survivor's bias, right? And then I'll say, well, you have loser bias. Like, what you're like, what are you doing? What great things are you doing? So I think this is a tense time we live in, and we do need people to navigate us through this minefield, because it's not super simple.
Yeah. And I feel like men are desiring to be leaders, desiring to be patriarchs. And like you said, they're weighing the risks of being outcast by society or being canceled. And they're not willing to take that risk, even though deep inside, there's still that human desire and that male instinct, but also that's how God planned it. And knowing that's God's design, that they desire to be patriarchs, they're just scared to do it. You mentioned it.
What's set you free? What set you free, man? Because I've seen your, this is old fat Timothy. This is in shape Timothy. This is Timothy when lust had a hold of him. This is me free now. What was you say men have desire and they're scared to take that step. What was it for you that helped you take that step?
Well, for me, it wasn't, it was almost losing everything. You know, it was getting caught, almost getting divorced, almost losing my children, and realizing I was left with nothing, and I was hollow and empty. I've been searching for fulfillment and trying to fill a God-sized hole with porn and sex and everything else. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, it took almost losing everything and being exposed for me to realize that. But God uses unique ways to speak to us. And so he was able to speak into my heart, into my life, and realize what I was searching for was him.
Mm-hmm. That's
awesome. You know, I wasn't searching for, I was searching for God on Pornhub. And until I actually started searching for him, I didn't find that fulfillment. So when I found him and put him first in my life, then I was able to make the changes in my life I needed to make and work on repairing my marriage and work on healing the relationship with my children and then become a leader in my church. And I think that's important to do it in that order. It starts at the home first, and then it goes into the community, into the church.
Yeah. Amen. That's great.
Yeah. So, you know, one of the things you talk about in your book and on your website is dominion. Genesis says that God gave man dominion over all living things. What does that mean? And how does that apply to modern men?
Little boys love to dig in the dirt. They just love it. And there's that funny meme, you know, there's all these girls in a beach walk around their bikinis, and then there's these guys that are like digging the biggest hole they could ever dig on the beach, and all these guys surround the hole. They're like, oh my goodness, I've never seen a hole this big on a beach. And so it's interesting that men have that inclination. Men also have, they are better at mental transformation than women are. So they look at something and they can take it apart in their head or put it together. So they can look at a mountain and imagine what it would look like with a castle on it much easier. So guys like Tesla were able to entirely build their plans in their head, right? They'd have blueprints. They'd hold together. It's kind of like the masculine mind on steroids.
Vision.
And they could see it real. And so men are like that. That's why men are a little more handy. They're designed by God to build and shape things, right? And so part of what is so important about guys is that they are given a desire to build and shape and make, right? A desire to take dominion. Now, when we hear dominion, we think about it purely in like to dominate,
right?
But I have to take dominion over my grass, right? My grass grows up and pushes against me, and my lawnmower cuts it back down, right? You want to know where a man is in his household? We'll go look at his beds. Are they, did he or his kid or his wife, have they been weeded, right? Is there leaky faucets everywhere? Is there something broken? Is he taking dominion over his home? Does he dominate and control his space? Now, you dominate it not just for selfish desires, but again, according to God's design, God's plan, God's will, God's word, however you want to say it. That's what Christian dominion is, right? That's what guys lack, is that they don't, how can you lead a woman if you can't lead yourself, right? Mm-hmm. In the book of 1 Timothy 3, we see that to be a leader in the household of God, the church, a man has to manage his own household well. Well, household is where we get, the word economics, right? House law. And if you're not able to have a house that's well ordered, not just relationally, but also financially, structurally, how in the world are you going to take care of the church? And so you can walk that back. A man will never be able to lead his wife well if he can't lead himself well. I always tell my kids that self-discipline is learning to tell yourself yes and no, right? And until you, and I tell them right now, I stand between you and bad decisions, right? But my goal is to get you to where you don't need me. You know, because the worst thing a father could do to someone that wants to make bad decisions, let him do it. That's why when excommunication in scripture, Paul says he delivers someone over to Satan for the destruction of their flesh. In other words, like, look, if you're going to continue to pursue all this wicked, evil stuff, one, we're not going to allow you to have membership in the church. Two, we'll let you go have it, right? You want to see how good this is? Go have it, man. You know, and then they get burned. It's like, my kid, I kept telling him when he was little, Hudson, my oldest son, not to put his hand in this hot coffee. And he wouldn't listen. So I let him put his hand in the hot coffee to burn his fingers. Never did that again. And so we have to take dominion over ourselves first. So pornography is not, you're not ruling your desires and aiming them. Sex is very powerful. Sexual desire will move a man to get things done. You know, guys are willing to go to some pretty crazy lengths to have sex.
Right.
It's pretty wild. And women think that makes them a dog. And I say, well, no, let's ask, what is the purpose of this? Why, where does this energy come from? Well, it comes from a desire to build things for the glory of God, to dominate. It's interesting. Women want to be dominated. It wasn't men that bought those 50 million copies of 50 Shades of Grey. We're not into that. When men find out what women's sexual fantasies are, men are usually disgusted. So women are disgusted by men in porn. Oh, I don't get it. How can he be like that? Well, number one, men have 10 times more of the testosterone than you do, right? We really do think about sex a lot. You know, if we're hormonally healthy, it's a daily thing. Okay. Days don't go by. It doesn't happen. Women aren't like that. And it's interesting that male fantasies tend to be about a woman willingly and excitedly giving herself to a man and accepting his masculinity without any judgment. Right. And the female fantasy is about a strong and worthy masculine man taking control, right? Sin can twist it and then go dark, weird places, And when I look at something like BDSM, I think this is just people with daddy issues. This is just people that haven't ever had the structure of a family. They've never known what strength looks like controlled or named properly. So they try to, create it, and it's this, there's like a grain of truth to it, but it's been twisted. And so women respond, men act, right? Yeah. Adam's made first, he's made from the dirt to rule the dirt. Eve's made second from Adam, and she's brought to Adam to help Adam. So I tell people this all the time. There's a great study that they put these two chairs in a room, and they had some boys come in and they had some girls come in. the boys aim the chairs out at the world, and the women aim the chairs at each other. So they sit so they can look, you know,
right.
And come on, this is like common sense. We really need to study for this, but it's interesting. Men are looking outward to take control of. That's why video games, everyone says video games aren't masculine. They're not manly, but they are masculine, because video games are all about high scores, dominating, teamwork, taking control, building skills, getting excellent, finding how to exploit the rules and all that stuff. That's all it's about. That's super masculine. Guys will spend an hour arguing over the rules of a game before they play a game, because they care about the structure of things, how to win, how to conquer. So guys are built to dominate, and things like porn rob them of that sexual energy that pushes them out into the world. And things like video games takes it and locates it in a digital realm that has very little, if any, real world consequence, right? Sure. So people say, oh, well, it helps them build logical reasoning. Yeah, okay, sure. I'm sure there are things that can happen that way. But what we're seeing is that men's base desires to rule and lead over people in a good way have been diverted to destructive ends.
And I think they're destructive ends and less risky ends. So porn is one, video games. And another area that I see a lot is the like fantasy football, where guys are trying to lead and build a team. So I think these are ways that men are crying out to try to have those male things, like you talk about video games and dominating and winning and racking up points and all that. But there's no risk in those things. There's no risk in porn. There's no risk of being ostracized in video games and fantasy football. Yeah, you might lose money, but there's no risk of being cast aside in society or told you're not a man. And I think that's why some of those things become so addictive for men, because it can make them feel like a man, but doesn't really require them to be one.
Yeah, it's an avatar. It's sure. They represent, it's funny. So we have a covenantal design by God. In other words, we live in these communities and we experience, as the community goes, so do we. So the king comes back from war and all the people, like, our nation's a winning nation, right? The king just won the war. He's coming back in. Matter of fact, that's where the word gospel comes from. Gospel would come from when a king is returning from conquering, and they would give this good news. It would be a proclamation of how they had won this battle or whatever. And so we participate in that. And it's here in Cincinnati. I don't watch football anymore for a variety of reasons, but here in Cincinnati, we had the Bengals, right? So the Bengals, the Bungles, they've been one of the worst football teams for years. They've gotten better in the last decade, but man, there was like 20 years where it was, it was bad. And maybe not as bad as the Lions, but bad. But
as long as you're better than the Detroit, it's all right.
Yeah. Yeah. And so Monday mornings, it was like Cincinnati was downcast, because the Bengals had lost probably to the Steelers. And people, they derive that sort of communal identity that way. And again, it's being directed towards things that don't matter, that are very consumeristic. It makes sense to me that guys care about numbers and strategy, because all football is warfare. All sports is ritualized warfare.
Sure.
I mean, that's literally what the Olympics were. They took these different aspects of throwing a javelin, wrestling, whatever, these different aspects that are involved in warfare and made a game out of it, this show. And so I get why they want to participate in war and conquering and winning, but it is not entirely different from video games. It really isn't. The fantasy football is very similar. And I say, care about, make that, there's a place for that, for recreation in your life, but it has to be sublimated to more important things. Like, what's your finances look like? What's your health look like? What are your kids doing? How are they educated? What's going on in your community? You know, oh, there's been 10 wrecks down at that intersection. Maybe you're the dude that gets the stop sign there or gets a light there. You know, what are you taking responsibility for anything, or is your responsibility, you just got to get, you know, find a decent quarterback because your main guy went down with a knee injury this week. You know, I mean, come on.
Yeah. And those things become identities, especially with sports. Sports has become, like you say, it's like warfare. Football, obviously, you're trying to conquer someone else's territory and go in and take their end zone as their home, and you're trying to take their territory. And so I think that's why men live vicariously through sports, because there's that inner desire to conquer and for war and to battle and have a battle to fight. But it becomes all encompassing. I mean, I see that all the time at work. I'm a funeral director, and I'm in suburban Philadelphia. And so the Eagles here are a religion.
Oh yeah.
And I'll do this funeral. This guy who lived this great long life, who'd be 90 years old, you know, have children and grandchildren and great grandchildren, a good long career, happy family. What does everybody get up and talk about at the funeral? They talk about how much he loved the Eagles, and they'll sing the Eagles fight song at the funeral. It becomes so much of an identity. And I hate seeing that. It's like, when I go, I want my children, my daughters, to have more to say about me than how much of a fan I was of X football team. But unfortunately, for so many men, that's their identity.
We've become spectators and not participants in life.
Right.
We watch other people do great things. We don't do great things ourselves. Yeah, absolutely. It's very sad.
Yeah. Yeah.
There is funerals are funny. Funerals are funny in that more truth and more lies are told at funerals and weddings than anywhere else, I feel like.
Oh, I believe that.
Yeah. As a pastor, you know, I've had to be part of funerals, and you'll hear people talk about how great a guy he was. You're like, he was a horrible dude. What are you talking about? This was a bad man. He is not a good guy. And all we can say is like, well, we're sorry that he ended his life the way he did, and God have mercy on all of us, you know? So,
yeah, we try to preach people into heaven, and death, you know, death is a great equalizer. You know, it comes for everyone, obviously. And, you know, that's where, when you come, we all end up at the same place. You know, we all have to face our maker at some point. You wrote a excellent piece about you and your wife, Emily, having lost your daughter.
Yeah.
And it was beautifully written, and something such a heart-wrenching and tragic event, that you still were able to keep your hope in Christ and not lose faith. And in that piece, you said something that has completely stuck in my mind since you wrote it. In that you said, God does not waste death. Mm-hmm. Tell me what you meant by that.
Well,
what that means.
God is sovereign over everything and controls everything. He doesn't merely permit things, you know, he causes them. Like so I would tell people, like, well, God is the one that took my daughter. Oh, don't say that. That was the devil. Do you think God has power of the devil? I do. So God could have stopped the devil, but he didn't. You think that's a better position? No, God is sovereign. He causes everything. There's a difference between primary causes directly causing something and secondary causes. So you got a guy that uses a saw to saw a board, right? The saw is doing the actual sawing, you know? So God is behind every terrible event, ultimately, that's ever happened without being morally culpable for it. And that's a hard thing to wrap our head around, but that's the teaching of Scripture, very clear. And the easiest way we can start to explain how that's possible is the idea of primary and secondary causes. There's still things you got to tease out, but you know, how does take the light particle wave theorem, right? Light exists both as a particle and a wave at the same time. There's a lot of hard things to understand in this world. but I know God is behind everything, right? He ordains every little hair on our head, everything. And so with Nicaea, when she died, the Lord did a lot of things. He changed me as a person forever. I grew up a pretty intuitive, sensitive kid in a family of addicts and a family of a dysfunctional family. And I went to 8 different schools growing up, just because we kept moving every year looking for this new place. I never had any roots except when I lived with my grandmother, who raised me for a portion of my life, is probably why I'm very different from my brothers. It led me to be emotionally repressed, I think, because sensitive kids are funny. That sensitivity is good. what you got to do though is you got to teach kids to have hard outer core and a soft inner core, right? And most people have a soft outer core and a heart, you know, so thick skin, soft hearts is what we go for. But my heart had been made hard, and I kind of lacked a normal emotional range that men should have. And I know this is a thing because people watched that show Dexter years ago, where it's like this serial killer that has to pretend to have these normal emotions or whatever. And that was really resonated with a lot of people. And I think, yeah, this is sort of the psychology of people from a broken family that don't have, they're saying, oh no, this is a superpower. That no, you're not, you're retarded. Like, there's a real issue. So when Nicaea died, it made me feel things that I didn't know I could feel. It was intense. I always tell people it's like having your eyes dilated, you know, and suddenly all the light is coming in. And so it gave me back my emotions. I was able to feel, I couldn't stop feeling the pain for a long time. And, you know, it's still like, yeah, every once in a while, we're coming up on, it's been 9 years, it's crazy to think that. But and then it really changed Emily too. She was in a deep depression for about 6 months. And I wondered if I was going to get my wife back. I just told her she had to get over it because we had three boys that were still alive. I was like, mm-hmm. They need mom, right? Nicaea ain't coming back. And these guys. But what it did though, it really reshaped who we were, how we communicated. When death happens, especially of a child, it'll either pull a couple apart or pull them close together. It's like
I see that all the time.
It's very common. And you'll find out like what's been holding the marriage together. And I remember when Nicaea died, I told them that now we get to decide if we're really Christians or not. That's how I put it to her.
Wow.
You know, and I said, we get to decide if like we really believe God is good and all things work to good for those who love him. We get to decide if God's sovereign. We get to decide if the reason the good news is good is because Jesus has given us a way to not just to take care of our sins, but a way to overcome death and be resurrected forever. We get to decide if all these truths are true. And so what death does is it gives you an opportunity to ask, what am I about? Is the gospel really the gospel? Do I really trust God? What is my relationship founded on? And that's why you see so much of Twitter. So much of Twitter is so much BS. It's about, you got some 20-something single guys lecturing you on what it means to be a man. They don't have any family. They have very little leadership. Oh, you and your difficult life with your email list selling your crap product that everyone's been selling. You know, and you just hear them like lecture everybody, and they're almost always cut and pasting other guys and just recycling the same material. You just see the same stuff over and over. Oh no, this guy's going to be the big marketer for a moment, and they'll fade. But you just think, man, these guys don't have a lot of skin in the game, not in the real life, and they talk about things theoretical. But when death starts happening, and things, you know how it is. You're a funeral director. These things don't always happen on a schedule.
I can tell you that.
These things, like sometimes you're older and you're expecting someone to die. And a lot of times it's one day, things are one way, and the next day they're another way. And you're shocked to your core, and your actual foundation comes out. And so God used the death of our child to change me as a person, to challenge our marriage. It also gave me ability to speak into other people's life and just tell them to stop being victims. We're surrounded by, I call them drama vampires. There's like people that had some terrible experience in their past and they come to you to live off you, right? They're like, want to be with you in the drama. And they're going to say it's that, oh, I'm just a wounded healer. But no, it's like, you've never gotten over that loss you had. And now this person has this new loss. Oh, I've been through it too. Let me talk about my pain with you. Let's share this together. Those people will keep you stuck in a place. And so when Nicaea died and I wrote some blog posts about it that went viral, I got like 1,000 emails. People were sending money. People are really kind. But I remember one email I got. This woman said, my son died 18 years ago. And still every day I go to his grave. Let me tell you, that's unhealthy.
Yeah.
That's weird. That's not right. That's not good. You know, the first couple of weeks or whatever, But no, you need to move on. He's dead and you're stuck. And it got me to a place now where, you know, people say, you don't know me, man. You don't know my pain. I know something about pain. You know, I always say, have you ever held a baby, a little white baby covered in blood, you know, because the blood's been drained out of her? Have you ever done that? Well, no, I haven't. All right. Well, let's stop talking about each other's pain and start talking about what's right. And so it gave me ability to speak into people's life, both with compassion, but with a firmness that they need. Let's stop living in this place and move forward, you know?
Yeah. I think death has a way of, you know, it pulls the rug out from under you, and you either, this is combining metaphors here, but it becomes sink or swim, you know, and too many people allow it to sink them instead of rising up to the occasion and filling that void. You look at, you know, centuries past, you know, the prince couldn't become the king unless the king died.
Yeah.
And so he had to step up and fill that role. And that's, death does that. It creates a void. And are you going to just wallow in that void and just sit in your misery, or you're going to step up and try to fill that void?
Yep. And like you said, we're all going to die. We're all going to die. What are you doing, man?
Yeah.
What are you doing? I, you know, to tie it all back together with some of the manosphere stuff, what I see is men that are traumatized. They want to live in that trauma.
Right.
And they're just stuck there. They're like those same people. They won't move on.
Happy being a victim.
And so, you know, we have Tyrannus Hall, which is it's like $35 a month. It's our online men's group that guys kept asking for, so we created one. I actually talked to Zach Small and Craig, who does Fraternity of Excellence, and you're part of that, and asked for advice. And they told me it's similar. You guys use we use Discord. I think you guys use Slack, mm-hmm. but we talked a little bit, and so we didn't exactly copy your guys' model, but I borrowed a lot. Don't recreate wheels, but but we do have guys on occasion that come into Tyrannus Hall. That's probably more of a FOE thing, or I don't know, maybe, but you have guys that are just came out of the divorce and they're raw. And all they want to talk about is how women suck and how hard life is and how America is dystopian and whatever. And I'm like, that's not what our group's for. Our group is for guys who maybe are still feeling that, but they've moved on to the, like, how do I get past this and take steps, right? And what's good about death is that I think you can sit there traumatized. And I think that presupposes that you have all this time, right? But death reminds you, you don't. Right. And time is so fast. So here's what happens. When you drive to work, the first time you drive to work, it takes 20 minutes and it feels like 20 minutes. But when you start to drive to work over and over again, same time, same path, your brain turns off. So sometimes you like had your cup of coffee and you straight up don't even remember your drive to work. Like, you know, you got in the car, you know, you did it, but like that 20 minutes you don't remember. Well, that's because our brain naturally sets into autopilot, like repeated task it'll do, whether it's learning how to do a punch or anytime you do the same thing over and over again, your brain will do it automatically and you almost aren't aware of it. Life is like that. The longer you live, the less new experiences you have, the more on autopilot you are. Huge portions of your life just pass by. You don't remember it. You're on autopilot. These guys in trauma are on a trauma autopilot. They're stuck there,
right?
And they don't know that the sands of time are falling and time is slipping away. And then you see a friend. I saw a guy recently that was 40 that had like a heart attack, and I was like, dang, I'm 40, you know. So you start to realize, like, okay, if I die today, what happens to my kids? What happens to my wife? What have I set up? What have I done? I was doing an interview for my day job. I asked this guy, you know, all the time I do at the end of interviews, people do this, well, do you have any more questions for me? And I always ask them crazy questions just because I don't know, I like to mess with people, you know. Have you ever walked out of a movie? Which one and why? You know. But the other day, I said this in a joking way, but I said, "Sure, man. What's your greatest fear?" And I thought the question being an interview would be absurd, and he would laugh, and we'd laugh together, and be like, "All right, we'll follow up with you." Instead, he says, "Oh man, I fear. I'm scared of never accomplishing anything worthwhile."
Wow.
And I won't lie, man, this makes me sound like a jerk. I laughed out loud a little bit because it was such like this intense
answer. We weren't expecting that.
So it took me by surprise, but I thought, yeah, okay, that is good place to be as long as that fear doesn't just stay navel gazing and thinking.
As long as
about
it drives action.
Yeah, as long as it drives action. And so we have to help men get free of this trauma, of this hurt, of this pain, right, this self-focus. And actually, you know, I like to ask some of the guys in the ministry, do you think men are great? Do you think patriarchy is powerful? Do you think men can lead women, right? Or are women so bad that they won't follow men? Mm-hmm. All right, if men are so great, why won't some women follow? And then they look at my marriage. Oh, well, we didn't get lucky like you. Dude, we almost divorced the first 3 years. It was like we put, you know, a good 10 years of arguing into 3 years. It was intense. I always tell people, Emily was like a Mustang. You had a brake, you know, and it was hard. Or another better analogy, my favorite metaphor is Rocky II. So Rocky II, at the very end, they both knock each other down. They beat the hell out of each other, right? It's whoever stands up first wins the fight. And Apollo is trying to get up on the ropes and Rocky is like working his way up and Rocky gets up and he wins. Well, that's what it felt like in our marriage, is that we get in these arguments and trying to outlast my wife and win the argument was exhausting. But eventually I started to win some and then also mix that with me taking control of my own life, getting better at things and on top of it. And it slowly has led to my marriage is an oasis in a desert, and I love it. 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 I'm going to go upstairs and sit next to her and read the Bible with my kids here. Once we get off this, it's going to be great. Awesome. And God can work to do great things in men if they will stop feeling sorry for themselves and stop thinking of all these things that are excuses that overwhelm them with anxiety, that then drive them back into pornography or drive them back into video games or drive them back into something that allows them to neglect their responsibility and their ability to do things for the glory of God. That's what we have to do.
So if you had to issue a challenge to men here in your platform and everything, what would you challenge men to do today to embrace being a man and to get them to understand why it's good to be a man and why they should strive for that?
So an easy way to kind of break people free is there's roughly 30 days in most months. So just read a chapter of Proverbs every day, right? And then meditate. So meditate is not emptying your mind, but it's focusing your mind on something. Meditation is the tea bag soaking in the hot water, right? So meditate on Proverbs and ask like, okay, how is this calling me to action today? And then one simple way is flee and pursue. 2 Timothy 2:22, pretty popular verse for trying to help people fight sexual sin. But, you know, flee sexual immorality and youthful lusts and pursue righteousness with those that call on God from yada, 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 right? So what are the things that this passage is telling me I need to flee? And what are the things pursue? What are the things I should be going after? So you can't just have a no vacuum. You have to have a yes positive. And so where are you going to go? So I'd say start there. Like, ask yourself that. What is this convicting me of today? What is it calling? What action? And then spend some time praying and ask, Father, help me grow in these areas. Father, forgive me where I've sinned. Father, I praise you. Now give me strength to go do this. And then take action on that. Just start to take action in your own life. Incremental, step-by-step action. And it's the bike chain metaphor. If you've ever had the chain fall off your bike, it falls, you got the two gears. What you do, you get it on the large gear, or well, you get on the small gear, and then you get on the partially another one, and you turn the pedals, and then boom, the chain link pops right back onto the gears, right? So guys, a lot of times, like, well, what's step 10? Don't worry about it. Take step one, okay? Step one is the bike chain, getting on the gears, turn the pedals, and these steps will start to flow from each other. But number one is, take responsibility for yourself before God. Start communicating with God, getting into his word, praying, chewing, thinking about it. You know, I know that for me, the biggest step, one of the biggest changes I ever did is carving out a lot of time for that sort of meditation and study. And so I'm up most days. I'm not like, I'm not like Jeff. He's always up lifting weights at 3:40 for some reason. Yeah. I always want to put, it's 3:40, time to go pee, you know, and then go back to sleep. So it happens in your 40s. But anyhow, but I do get up pretty early, 4:45, 5 o'clock. Mm. And then I spend really 5 to about 7:30 writing, reading, following up on things. My family's still usually asleep, and I'm ahead of them, and I make time for that stuff. And that really determines my day. I don't watch TV. Who has time for it? You know, but I don't have a pro, like, cut some of these things out. Stop being a consumer and start being a producer, and just take the first steps. Don't worry about having it all figured out. Just get some action, get some forward movement.
Great. This has been an awesome conversation. Appreciate you coming on. I know you have It's Good to Be a Man, the book coming out. So tell us about that quick before we wrap up.
Sure. You can go to Canon Press, C-A-N-O-N, Canon Press. They're our publisher. The book is released in hardcover and digital. It's a little ways out. It's November 30th of this year, 2021, for those listening in the year.
Great Christmas present.
Yeah, it's a good Christmas present. And it's a book that is not, most books on manhood is all about women. It's almost always about marriage. Our book only gets to marriage in the very, very last chapter. It really is about how manhood has been, what's the spiritual reality behind manhood being despised? How can you reclaim your manhood? And why is it good to be a man? We walk through chapter by chapter explaining this stuff. And I think it would be helpful for anyone that is just like, know something's wrong, but doesn't know what to do. That's the people we wanted to help. People that have had their eyes open, like, no, culture is wrong. I don't want to be some beta, soy, weak dude. But I also don't want to be some macho blowhard. Like, what is the right way? So we tried to work through that biblically in a way that speaks to the issues today. We decided we didn't want to write a timeless book. We're not that talented, but we thought maybe we can write a timely book that would help men now. And so that's our modest contribution to helping men get going. So it's available on Canon Press. You can find me on Twitter at This Is Foster. You can check out our website. It's good to be a man.com. We just put up, we have a weekly newsletter that goes out. It's been going out for 2 years. We just put out a year's worth of back issues up there on notes.itsgoodtobeaman.com. So those are some places people can check us out.
Awesome. Great. Michael, thanks for coming on today. Appreciate it. Keep preaching the word and spreading the gospel and the good news and helping men. Appreciate what you do.
Yep. Thank you. Likewise. God bless. Right.
This has been an episode of the Into the Wilderness podcast. This is Timothy Regal. Thank you for listening. For additional content and to learn more about Into the Wilderness, visit www.intothewildernessblog.com. You can follow me on Twitter, Instagram, and all other social media at Timothy Regal, TimothyReigle. If you're like me and many other men, you've struggled with porn. I was addicted for over 15 years and thought I would never break free. But through accountability, hard work, and never giving up, I found freedom from porn and sex addiction. If you're fighting the same battle, know there is hope. You can defeat this, but you cannot do it alone. That's why I offer one-on-one coaching to walk beside you in your battle. I'll provide personal guidance, support, and encouragement. And most importantly, accountability to keep you on track and help you reach your goals. So if you're ready to finally quit porn for good, if you're ready to put in the hard work, and if you're ready to finally take control of your life back, click on the link in the show notes to go to www.intothewildernessblog.com or DM me on Twitter or other social media to get started in your path to freedom today.